with me, Joe Fidgen. Over the next hour, we'll be stopping off in India, England and Indonesia. But we're starting the programme today in the American Midwest with the remarkable story of Dawn Prince Hughes. She'd always felt very uncomfortable around people, and it wasn't until her mid-30s that she was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome. But she found an extraordinary way to cope with her anxiety after an encounter with gorillas. She told me all about it during a visit to the zoo in St. Louis, Missouri, and at her home in southern Illinois.
Welcome to my home. This is Woodstone Burrow Animal Sanctuary. We have on the porch Winnie the Blind Horse and Scout the Mini Pig. We have lots of chickens. I have 5 Pomeranian dogs. Have to get Winnie's breakfast dish. Hi, honey. Should I sing you your morning song? She's a little blind mare with a heart of gold and a soft brown eye and a soul so old. Okay, I'll get your food. I'll be right back. I've been looking for answers to why I was so angry all the time. And looking online, I saw that it was really obvious that I was on the autism spectrum. I looked at the science behind it. I interviewed my parents and anyone who ever knew me and got copious notes about how I acted at what different ages and how that corresponded to each of the features of the diagnosis, and compiled it into about an inch thick paper. And then, in reverse order of most people, I called a psychiatrist and asked for a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome. And of course, there's a long pause on the phone, and the woman said, "Well, you'll have to come in for that and let me ask you the questions." Later, she laughed, though, and said, "You know, I really could have diagnosed you on the phone."
What were you expected to say to her?
Nobody but somebody on the autism spectrum would call and say, "I need a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, and you will give that to me."
What is Asperger's?
People are not sure. It seems to be related to things like obsessive compulsive disorder, Tourette's syndrome, anxiety disorder.
How did it affect you as a child?
Everything was more intense for me than it was for other people. Light was brighter, sound was louder, touch was painful, my clothing was scratchy, even though it should have been considered soft. Just this major onslaught constantly, a barrage of sensory overstimulation, which in turn made it very difficult to relate to people, to be able to slow down enough to pick out patterns like speech and facial expressions and things like that. A grocery store is a real nightmare. It's a riot of competing smells and sights and sounds, that clang of shopping carts, the horrible squeaking wheel, the lighting, the flicker of the fluorescent lighting. And so the idea of focusing on someone's face and listening to what they say, it would be like trying to have a conversation in the middle of a marching band while someone was forcing you to smell Limburger cheese and hitting you on the chest violently. You just can't do it. I wanted things to be very predictable. It would have to be that we had things done at a certain time, that we took a certain route to school.
What would happen if you took a different route?
I would get really violent, angry. I would have to rely on coping mechanisms. For example, holding a purple cup on my face for hours at a time, walking around with this cup where all I could see was this metallic purple, which made me feel so comforted. I used to love to play in the stream. I would look for crawdads, what people call crayfish, very gently. You know, I would take the rock up off the bottom of the stream bed, and the crawdads would just shoot everywhere. There's a baby. There's a baby right there. They move backwards to get away. See? I love it here. And whenever I came here, I'd like to take my clothes off and run through the woods naked. My clothes were really scratchy and painful, and I always liked feeling the wind on my skin.
How early on did you realize that you were different?
6 years old. It would be about that time where I was starting to be expected to interact with children my own age. They thought I was a freak. And it was sort of a downward spiral as I felt more and more rejected. The stranger and stranger I became, and the more and more they rejected me. This is the notebook that I have all my early writings in. This poem I wrote when I was drunk. You could tell by the writing.
How old were you then, do you think?
Seventh grade.
Which is what sort of age? 12, 13?
Mm-hmm. 12.
And you were drunk?
Mm-hmm. I did drink a lot. Things had become dangerous for me in school. People had started attacking me physically, threatening to kill me. I remember walking down to the highway and hitchhiking out of town.
Where did you go?
I just started drifting, going anywhere with anyone who had a home or would give me drugs or alcohol.
How long did that go on for?
5 years. I was just checking my watch, waiting to die. Whenever I could, I went to the dance clubs. There was something about that driving, incessant beat. It was so loud and oppressive that it essentially blocked everything else out. Normally, I danced just by myself. I didn't really want to notice anyone else. But I remember vividly one night a woman coming up to me, sticking some money in my pants almost jokingly and saying, "Wow, you're a great dancer, and you've got some great moves. I actually dance downtown, and you should come check it out and make some money with that thing." I remember saying something like, "Well, that's really not my style," or whatever, and she's like, "You're homeless. Is that your style?" I thought, okay, it can't be worse. I'll go try it out, and I did. I guess you would call it a peep show. People would drop quarters into a machine, and a window would raise, and for a quarter you would get, I don't know, 20 seconds to view the naked dancers on the stage.
What kind of dance did you do?
I was the wild woman. I would often wear skins or fur, little bikini things, and rage around the stage, running around like a wild animal. I remember leaping across the stage, jumping and positioning myself on the windows. We had bars that you could hold on to on each side of the window. And I remember some of the customers sort of reeling back. Whoa, what was that? As I would caper around and fly toward the window and make wild noises. It was a little bit like a zoo exhibit now that I think of it.
But your life was about to change very dramatically.
Yes. With one of the very first paychecks I took from that job, I thought, I'll go to the zoo. I was terrified to go. For somebody with Asperger's, the idea of finding the right bus, having the right change, interacting with people, all these things that people take for granted, these little steps, were really terrifying. But I managed to navigate my way to the zoo. Okay, this is the worst part. Listen, it's loud, people are loud, colors are loud. Ah, makes me dizzy. Hello there. Could I have a safari pass? Good. Thank you so much. And I walked around a while, and I went around the corner. I saw the gorillas for the first time. And it was an epiphany. I knew immediately that these were people that would understand me and that I would understand them. And as I stood there near them, all of the sensory information coming in, the world that had moved too fast, the sound that had been too loud, the light too bright, everything just hushed. And I rested. For the first time in my life, I was able to rest.
What struck you about the gorillas? What drew you to them?
They're very slow and very deliberate. Human communication happens so fast, but there's nothing frenetic about gorillas. Smell that? Gorillas. Like rhubarb pie, lemons, and horse dung. I've always found eye contact difficult because when you really look at somebody, the amount of information that's going back and forth is an intense experience. When I went to see the gorillas for the first time, they kept just glancing at me over the shoulder. That was the speed at which I needed to go.
Did that remind you of yourself and your own reluctance to make prolonged eye contact?
It did, because I got the sense that, you know, and this makes sense on a survival level, that they really see very keenly. And staring would have been overwhelming for them as well. I think it was really the same. He's looked over several times, glancing over to see what I'll do. Every time he's glanced over, I immediately glance away, lower my head, my body, try to send him an invitation.
What sound is that?
Contentment. They do it when they roam through the forest eating. They can't see each other very well. They can hear the whole group. I'm here, all is well. Everything's all right. I started going back as often as I could, every day if I could. I just wanted to be with them. It's so funny because people on the spectrum will seize on something that interests them and they have to know all about it. That's why we have so many professors, you know, that are probably undiagnosed spectrum folks. But I started reading books about gorillas and I watched videos, and whenever the staff would go by, I would almost literally grab them and say, "Stop, I needed to ask you about this," or, "Did you know that gorillas do this?" Or they were very encouraging, and I had somebody say, "You know, you should volunteer here. You clearly love it. Fill out a form, get on the waiting list." And I did. And I really feel that just sitting there with them for what stretched out into years allowed my nervous system to heal.
Was that affecting the rest of your life? Was it changing your behavior outside the zoo?
I sensed watching the gorillas that social interaction could be very meaningful. And I had this emerging sense of wanting to share more with other people. I copied what the gorillas did exactly. If I was in a certain situation that I recognized was the same as I had seen the gorillas go through, I would be a gorilla in that situation. And it worked.
Give me an example.
Well, for example, when I saw that a gorilla was upset and another gorilla came over and gave a little pat on the back, and that was all that was needed, and it left. I copied that in a situation in my life, and it worked really beautifully. And it was the first time I had been really comfortable reaching over and trying to comfort someone and make that kind of contact.
So it's as though you learnt. The social rules of human behavior through watching gorillas.
I absolutely did, and I still see no difference.
Would you go so far as to say you became human by observing them?
Yes. The gorillas gave me my humanity. Here's something else you'll enjoy. It's Congo's foot.
It's enormous.
Yeah.
What's it cast in?
Just plaster of Paris.
He was a big guy.
Mm-hmm. It's funny how I could feel frightened around the smallest human child, and yet being next to Congo at 500 pounds, I felt so at home. I had been left alone in the office just for a minute, and I was lining up strawberries. We had a little ledge, a point where the cage met the office, and then there was a barred window so you could see what all the gorillas were doing at night. And I was lining up these wonderful fat strawberries for Congo, just so, in typical Asperger's fashion, and paying more attention to the strawberries and their perfect order, frankly. And as any self-respecting gorilla would, he was paying more attention to the juicy, wonderful strawberries and eating them as fast as he could. So he caught up to me and he touched my finger as I was putting down the next strawberry. And it really surprised both of us. I just stopped and I looked at his huge sausage of a finger on my tiny finger. And then I looked up at him in surprise, and he was looking at me with surprise. It was just the most magical moment where I felt like touch was a wondrous and essential thing, and I had never really liked it before. I knew at that moment that it was possible to enjoy the touch of another living thing.
I see one sitting up on that rock. I see another one. Big tummy.
To me, their faces are just so beautiful. Something very thoughtful about the way their eyebrow ridges go out. It's almost like an evolutionarily made shelter. One of the gorillas got really sick. Nobody could figure out what was wrong with her. And they knew that I was really observant, that I liked to just sit there and watch them for hours at a stretch. And so they said, why don't you go out and see what you can see? I took voluminous notes about everything that happened to this sick gorilla, how people treated her, how she looked, how she moved, what she ate, what she didn't eat. And based on that, we figured out she had a kidney infection. So the research director at the zoo said, you know, you have a gift for this. What are your plans for the future? The future? My plans? I really had never, ever thought about it. He said, well, you should go to school. And my immediate reaction was very negative. I never going back to school where people were mean and horrible and cruel. He said, well, let's just see what we can do. Take some basic courses. Don't commit yourself. Just see what you can do. And with his help, I started college and then started to incorporate the gorilla research I was doing in my college studies. And really the rest was history.
And you're now a professor of anthropology.
Yes, I was an adjunct professor of anthropology at Western Washington University for many years.
You've observed gorillas over many, many years, and seen them do some quite remarkable things.
Really funny gorilla story. Nina was the matriarch of the group. She was such a stately gorilla. And Nina had a burlap sack that she had torn apart. So it was a flat piece of material, and she'd worn it around her shoulders like a little shawl all day. And when she came over for lunch, which we would throw down from this access wall, she very daintily took the piece of cloth from around her shoulders, gave it a little shake, and then spread it out just perfectly like a picnic blanket. And smoothed it, and oh, there was a little thing here, and she picked it up and took the speck off the blanket. And when it was perfect, she sat down on the blanket and she was ready for lunch.
Did you come to see them as human beings?
You know, it's funny because I've been accused of anthropomorphizing gorillas, but I think, in fact, what I have done is I've gorilla-morphized human beings. I didn't see all these great traits in human beings before I saw them in gorillas. When I look at gorillas, I see people. And when I look at human beings, it's a little daunting, like they might experience if they were sitting down to have tea with a gorilla. Like, not so sure. It's just astonishing that a gorilla that I have never met would come and recognize that I was a gorilla. He came right to the window, face to face, and looked me in the eyes. And then he listened. He turned his ear. Did you see that? He turned his ear to hear my contentment grunts. And then he put his hand up and asked for me to put my hand up. So I put my hand up. He put a single finger up against the glass so that we could touch fingers. Astonishing. Astonishing.
How do you feel inside?
I feel elated. That was amazing.
Dawn Prince Hughes. Her latest book is called Circus of Souls, How I Discovered We're All Freaks Passing as Normal. We're back in a minute.